relevant at this moment when humanity is threatened by a possible nuclear war. Aside from using Ukraine to fight a proxy war against Russia, Young claimed that the Biden administration's overarching goal has been to strengthen Washington's hold over our European so-called allies. He explained, the Nord Stream bombing was a part of that strategy designed to make Germany, the largest economy in Europe, totally dependent on the U.S. For decades, Washington's biggest nightmare has been that Germany and Russia would ally, have their economies complement each other, and make the United States irrelevant. American journalist Seymour Hersh recently published reports blaming the bombing of the Nord Stream pipelines on the CIA and the Norwegian Navy, who he claimed acted on the instruction of President Joe Biden. Hersh said that the attack was largely intended to remove Berlin's ability to lift sanctions on Russia and resume buying Russian gas, which is significantly cheaper than American liquefied natural gas. These sanctions have been ineffective. According to the most recent figures from the International Monetary Fund, Russia's economy is set to grow faster than that of the UK and Germany this year, and faster than all of the G7 nations in 2024. Yet, the West continues to prepare more sanctions on Moscow out of incompetence, Young told RT. Our leaders are intellectually bankrupt. They don't know what they can accomplish and what they cannot accomplish. Fundamentally, they are stupid, and they don't have any other ideas, he said. The U.S. and its allies should therefore back off before the conflict in Ukraine spreads any further, he recommended. Young's position on Ukraine puts him at odds with the rest of the Democratic Party, who have voted in lockstep to continue the U.S. military support for Ukraine. Only a minority of Republicans in Congress have opposed this support, with 11 GOP representatives sponsoring legislation last month that would cut off the flow of weapons to Kiev. Young is challenging incumbent Governor Steve Beshear in the Kentucky Democratic primary this May. He ran for the House of Representatives as a self-described peace Democrat last November, but lost to Republican Andy Barr. According to Press TV, a war of words has been taking place between the U.S. and Russia over the destruction of Nord Stream pipelines in September last year. The Russian embassy to the United States said last month the United States should try to prove it was not behind the destruction of the Nord Stream gas pipelines that connected Russia to Western Europe. The embassy said in a statement, Moscow considers the destruction of Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 pipelines an act of international terrorism and will not allow it to be swept under the rug. Russia is asking the UN Security Council to order an independent inquiry into the September attacks on the Nord Stream gas pipelines. Russia gave the 15-member council a draft resolution which would ask UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to establish an international investigation into the sabotage and identify who was to blame. The US and NATO had called the September incident an act of sabotage. Moscow has blamed the West, but neither side has provided evidence. However, American investigative journalist Seymour Hersh said last month that US Navy divers had destroyed the pipelines with explosives. He said President Joe Biden personally issued the orders. A leading group of atomic scientists in the United States has said recently humanity is standing at its most perilous time on record, with the so-called doomsday clock advancing to within just 90 seconds of midnight Due to Russia-Ukraine crisis, Russia began its special military operation in Ukraine on February 24, 2022, with a declared aim of demilitarizing Donbas, which is made up of Donetsk and Luhansk self-proclaimed republics. The Kremlin believes the Ukraine conflict to be a proxy war waged against it by the US regime and its allies.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we will be discussing two major issues, the Iran-India trade ties and the freedom of two brothers from Guantanamo after 20 years. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Iran's trade with India crosses $2 billion, registering 59.57% rise compared to the previous year. And we shall also take a look at two Pakistani brothers reach home after spending 20 years at Guantanamo without charges.
Iran's trade with India has crossed the $2 billion mark. The Islamic Republic's total exports to India hit more than $600 million during the year 2022, registering a 63.09% rise compared to the corresponding period of the previous year. According to estimates, the potential capacity of Iran's exports to India is equivalent to $21 billion. Experts believe that facilitating trade between the two countries will lead to the development of the economics of both of the countries.
According to the recent figures released by the Indian Ministry of Commerce and Industries, the net worth of Iran's exports to India stood at $653 million in 2022. The figure was $409 million in the year 2021, thus showing a definite increase since last year. India, being a major buyer of Iranian crude oil, petroleum products imported by India from Iran estimated a total worth of around $175 million. The other exported products included dye intermediates worth $152 million, fresh fruit $148 million, and residual chemicals including allied products worth $40 million. Iran and India bilateral trade during the fiscal year 2022 rose to $2.5 billion from $1.693 billion in 2021, showing a 48% rise. On the other hand, India's exports to Iran have also shown a considerable increase. During January-December 2022, India's exports to Iran rose 44% to stand at $1.847 billion, while the figure was $1.284 billion in 2021. Rice has been Iran's major import from India during the year 2022. India has shipped $1.098 billion worth of basmati rice to Iran. The other exports from the South Asian country include tea worth $79 million, sugar worth $66 million, other types of rice worth $61 million, and organic chemicals worth $44 million.
India has a pivotal role to play in Iran's economic ambitions, paving a way for it to increase its power beyond its immediate neighbors and improve its financial dynamics. For New Delhi, Tehran is a cheap and important source of oil and also provides road to reach the vast Central Asian markets. According to experts, the Islamic Republic of Iran holds strategic importance for the country of India. However, the current ties are primarily governed by economic interests.
New Delhi and Tehran have converging interests in trade and connectivity. India and Iran have also been trying to diversify their channels of payment to increase bilateral trade. According to the Iranian Foreign Ministry, the two sides are preparing a roadmap for strategic cooperation between Iran and India that can help regulate long-term relations and protect from the impact of destructive factors. As regards in India's imports from Iran, mineral fuels and oils dominate the import basket, accounting for as much as 90% of India's total imports from Iran. However, according to experts, both Iran and India are interested in developing economic and trade relations beyond energy and petrochemical products. Complementarity between New Delhi and Tehran's economies provides a base for exploring non-oil areas, including goods and services, investment, tourism, education, handicrafts, etc. This, according to international affairs analysts, will pave the way for strengthening the economic relations between the two countries furthermore. The countries have been also trying to diversify the channels of payments to expand the already existing mechanism to cover more goods and services, including all of the non-petroleum products.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by Mr. Paul Cochran, an independent financial journalist from South Africa. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Iran's annual exports to India have risen considerably, reaching up to 60%. So how do you see the strengthening economic ties between the two countries in the context of the present world situation?
Over the past year between India and Iran, but it's still just 10%. Of what it was in 2019, when it was about $17 billion. And that stopped because of U.S. pressure after Trump, President Trump, pulled out of the nuclear deal. I mean, at that time, India was supplying around, was supplying around 10% of India's oil needs. And that trade could easily bounce back to those sort of figures. But that's very much dependent on if the conditions become more favorable, such as India being allowed by the U.S. to import more Iranian oil. And from what we're seeing, the U.S. isn't going to budge on this at all. But there's a lot of things happening, obviously, you know, globally, geopolitically, that could change things. And it makes utter sense, I mean, for India and Iran to strengthen economic ties, particularly given the geographic proximity. I mean, particularly since the COVID pandemic, more and more countries are diversifying their sourcing of goods and products, as well as nearshoring. So nearshoring is buying goods and getting goods from closer to home to not have these problems like happened during the height of COVID on getting products from one side of the world to your place. So you want to get them closer together. But again, it's as you know, it's the ongoing issue, the ongoing saga of the sanctions and preventing increasing ties and getting those figures back up to what they were back in 2019 of $17 billion plus.
Mr. Cochran, apart from oil trade, the two countries have conducted business in non-oil products as well. And now, don't you think more areas beyond energy and petrochemicals could be explored?
There's a lot of areas where there could be a lot more cooperation and more business and trade. After oil, it's primarily fertilizers that India wants from Iran, but also fruits and vegetables and vice versa. And Iran wants Indian rice and needs it and wants more of that as well as tea. These are big business ties. There's lots of money going involved with this. But the problem is, though, in many senses, that there's not a huge amount yet that either side can sort of offer each other in terms of services or technology. But there are definitely areas which there could be more cooperation or more sales. The car market, for instance, is a potential one. Both India and Iran have their own car industries. They have sizable industries, and they could increase sales to each other on those fronts. But it's technology as well is a big area that India is doing well in, and its economy is growing across the board on so many levels. India could be a very big player in terms of more investment in Iran. But as with everything else, always it's still the issue of the sanctions, and if India is given a bit more maneuverability to be able to increase this trade. doing the barter deals works to a level, but there needs to always be enough rupees in Iranian banks and vice versa for allowing this trade to happen because of the sanctions on being able to do trade in US dollars in particular, but also euros.
So you've mentioned sanctions and payments. Now, both countries are searching for options to diversify payment channels. So what can be a viable option helping India and Iran build long-term economic relations immune to third-country interference?
Well, this is the multi-billion dollar question, as it has been for years, how to be able to work around the sanctions and also how to be able to enable the payments to flow. Lots of options have been looked at. Some have even been tried. None seem to be that successful so far, primarily because the Western financial system is still so dominant and is proving very resilient to change. But given the sort of ongoing decoupling in many ways from the Western financial system by certain countries wanting to push that, particularly Russia, but also China, we also saw at the end of last year, the floating of a new global reserve currency through the BRICS countries. This could push things forward. And if more countries also shift away from paying for oil in dollars, as Iran has done, but we've also seen that now with Russia, of course. And if this grows bigger and bigger, this will allow more options and more viability for some of those things to happen. And that would be ultimately beneficial to Iran and India. But still, you know, the dominant financial system is still there. The sanctions are there. Everyone's very scared of falling foul of the US Treasury. They're scared of falling foul of the sanctions. You know, look what happened in 2019 with so many countries that had invested in Iran had to pull out. You also had many countries that were allowed to deal with Iran after the nuclear deal, the JCPOA agreement, but they did not over concerns and the risks of being fined by the United States.
Last but not least, sir, India is aspiring to become a global economic power and the country needs to have a reliable source of energy, therefore requiring Iran to fulfill its expansive energy needs. So how do you see the relations between the two countries further evolving in this context?
The relations between India and Iran have been getting better and have been getting stronger. We've seen that over cooperation in Afghanistan. And we're also seeing that not directly, but through more connections, particularly between China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is also bringing in India and Iran through the International North-South Transport Corridor. That's going to be connecting India, Iran, Afghanistan, Russia, Central Asia, and Europe. And as this progresses and develops, that is going to be a big source of economic development and more trade. And the movements of goods within that immediate area, this is a big benefit. But India is really having to try and walk a tightrope between pleasing the Americans on one hand and needing cheap energy on the other for its economic needs. I mean, its economy is growing very fast. It's obviously a huge country. It's going to nearly be the largest populace on the planet. So it needs as much cheap energy as it possibly can. Which is where Iran played such a central role. I mean, back before 2019, providing 10% of India's oil needs is huge. And that needs to sort of come up there again for them to be able to have this a reliable and cheap source of energy. But India's obviously come under a lot of pressure over the past year for buying Russian oil. And so it's going to have to really be careful in how it considers buying and getting more Iranian oil, despite that it making utter sense on a geographic and economic level.
There you have it, Mr. Paul Cochran, independent financial journalist from South Africa. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Samri Backup tweeted, Iran-India trade hit $2.5 billion in 2022, a 48% rise in comparison to 2021 when the figure stood at $1.693 billion. Rice was India's main export item to Iran, while oil was Iran's main export to India. Ross wrote, "It's already happening. Russia is developing economic and military ties to China, India, and Iran, developing economic ties to Saudi Arabia. These countries will no longer be using dollars to purchase oil. NATO and the EU are in chaos." Louis B. wrote, "The only economy that got worse was Europe and U.S. With good trade partners like China and India and Iran, Russia is doing better than Europe and U.S."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Last week, two Pakistani nationals were released from U.S. custody at the infamous Guantanamo Bay military prison facility after spending more than 20 years in imprisonment without any charges proven against them. The two brothers, Abdul Rabbani and Muhammad Rabbani, had been arrested in Karachi in 2002 and tortured in CIA custody before being taken to Guantanamo. They are the latest inmates to be freed from American custody, as the government claims to be working on emptying and closing the infamous prison.
The brothers Abdul Rahim Ghulam Rabbani, 55, and Muhammad Ahmad Ghulam Rabbani, 53, were arrested from Karachi in September 2002 by Pakistani security forces and handed over to the U.S. authorities. They were held at a CIA detention center in Afghanistan for almost 2 years before being transferred to Guantanamo. U.S. authorities had accused the two of providing some al-Qaeda members with housing, travel, and other support. According to sources, Ahmad Rabbani frequently went on hunger strikes and would be force-fed through a tube. U.S. military records describe the two brothers as providing little intelligence of value statements during the interrogations that were obtained on the ground of physical abuse. Mushtaq Ahmad Khan, the chairman of the Human Rights Committee in the upper house of Pakistan's parliament, stated that the duo was innocent but were detained without trial or access to any judicial help by the U.S. government, thus violating the international human rights conventions. The departure of the two brothers has reduced the detainee population at Guantanamo Bay to 32 men, all sent there during the years of the George W. Bush administration. During its war on terror, the United States has held about 780 detainees at the notorious prison complex.
Guantanamo Bay has been the center of controversy for unlawful detention, denial of judicial process, physical and psychological abuse, torture, and gross violation of human rights. The case of the Rabbani brothers highlights the human rights violations conducted by the U.S. government at different prison facilities. The indefinite detention of prisoners without charge or trial is a violation of international human rights laws that the United States has been disregarding over the years.
Established by the Bush administration in 2002, Guantanamo Bay military prison facility has been used as a detention camp for foreign terrorism suspects. The prison became functional after the September 11th attacks in New York that led to the cry of war on terror by the U.S. Over the past 20 years, more than 700 prisoners, all Muslims, have been detained at the ill-famed prison. During the peak years of war on terror, the facility held over 600 people accused of terrorism by the U.S. authorities. 20 years later, 32 inmates remain at the military detention center. According to the Pentagon, 18 have been cleared for transfer if stable third-party countries are willing to take them. The Guantanamo Bay facility has been indelibly marked with accusations of human rights violations and has drawn criticism for its indefinite detention without a trial policy. The U.S. government has long defended its indefinite detention policy at Guantanamo, claiming that such measures are necessary to protect national security. However, human rights groups have argued that these actions are illegal and have called for an end to the practice of indefinite detention.
Close Guantanamo!
As per international law experts, the full reckoning of harms caused by the disastrous war on terror can only begin when Guantanamo is closed for good.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by Mr. Ken O'Keefe, geopolitical analyst from Liverpool, England. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, in another instance of gross human rights violations committed by the U.S., two innocent Pakistani nationals were held for 20 years in Guantanamo prison without any proven charges. Now, has the international community failed to stand for the innocents suffering without trial in the U.S. prisons?
I don't think that there can be any serious questions to whether or not the obligations of the international community, in particular the bodies that deal with violations of international law, are being violated. And while the crimes are being committed, there are no prosecutions. And if we look at, say, the International Criminal Court, we see that African nations have been targeted, but I don't see one conviction, not one, not even any prosecution, of American war criminals for all of the various tortures, genocides, war of aggression, crimes against humanity, use of depleted uranium, experimental weapons. All of these things have been used in a place called Iraq, which I've been to as a Marine. So I've seen it with my own eyes. And it's ironic because those of us who believe in law realize that we must affect real and genuine lawful remedy. Because if we don't have lawful remedy, what alternative do we have? Violence. And we're leading towards World War III already with what's happening in Ukraine. So it really is time for people to take responsibility and understand that these bodies not doing their job is a reflection of us as people not doing our job. And if we do everything we're capable of, we will affect a lawful remedy process that will make convictions. And you know what? I only want the law. But law is brutal when it comes to committing the worst of crimes.
Mr. O'Keefe, the United States argues its human rights obligations are under international law. However, the truth shows otherwise. So the question is, why do these evident violations remain unpunished?
In order to understand how the world functions, it really is critical, and I've been saying this now for decades, and I stand by the position. In order to understand the way the world works, we really have to understand the nature of money and how it's produced and who has the money and how do they use that money and how much money do the rest of us have. If we look at the trail of money, we find that the bankers benefit profoundly from war. They also benefit from social strife and injustice. They benefit from debt, which is foistered upon the populations of the world. They are the ones that are pulling the strings. And unfortunately, we have not done what is necessary, and therefore it is absolutely essential that we recognize that our leaderships have failed us across the board. There are some exceptions, and ironically, I've just returned from Iran, and you know, I see more benefits in the society of Iran than I do in my own birth nation, which is literally taking a path towards Satan on multiple levels.
Sir, do you think any inquiry will be conducted anytime soon to look into these crimes?
You know, it really is important that what gets lost in the numbers and statistics is the people we talked about earlier, the Pakistani prisoners from Guantanamo who spent over two decades in there. It's not even just the victims of these types of things and what impact it has. I've been in a prison myself, one of the most notorious prisons in the world, and I've experienced torture firsthand myself. So I understand what this does to the average person and how difficult it is just on an individual level. But what about the families? You know, all of these people, these prisoners that are held without any due process of law, literally oftentimes incognito in places like Guantanamo. No access to your family, attorneys, representation, and no basic needs as even a prisoner. These things add up, and it creates a lot of pain for people that requires healing. And in order to affect healing, there's only one way, and that is through justice. How can you heal from a crime if there is never any justice? The only way then is through God, and you know, God will take care of God's part. We need to take care of the part down here on planet Earth. And affecting the law and lawful remedy is, I stand by it. This has got to be the way. So where we have improvements and necessary changes with regard to the law, let's do so. Let's hold our leaders to account. Let's stop shifting the blame to our leaders who are corrupt when we have to accept the fact that we're responsible for them.
Last but not least, Mr. O'Keefe, you've mentioned getting away with it. It's clear to the international community that there were and continue to be violations of human rights norms at different U.S. prisons, but there has been little done about it. So why has the international community failed in enforcing the law against the war crimes of the U.S.?
There are several layers of protection for the United States, which effectively provides immunity to it. In particular, the international laws governing the worst of crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, torture, genocide, things of this nature. The International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice are not doing their job. And they're able to get away with not doing their job by shifting the blame to other parties, such as rarely the United States and even less so Israel. These bodies shift the blame, so nobody takes responsibility and no prosecutions occur. But again, I did mention earlier, African convictions have occurred at the International Criminal Court. What, is Africa the only continent with international crimes being committed? I beg to differ. My birth nation of the United States is most responsible for these crimes, and yet the prosecutions don't exist. Why? Effectively, they're immune from prosecution through various inside Machiavellian means to effectively provide immunity.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Ken O'Keefe, geopolitical analyst from Liverpool, England, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Jacob Charai tweeted, "Uncharged Pakistani Guantanamo prisoners released after two decades. U.S. officials allowed two Pakistani brothers to return to their home country after holding them at Guantanamo Bay without charges for two decades. Abdul and Muhammad Rabbani accused the CIA of torturing them." Jeff Bickerton wrote, "The men were innocently imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay for 21 years. There was no trial, no court proceedings, no charges against them. U.S. military records describe the two as providing little intelligence of value. 32 people remain at Guantanamo." Imran Parrot Kid tweeted, "The detention of two Pakistani brothers for 20 years without charges at Guantanamo Bay is a clear violation of basic human rights. As a country that claims to champion human rights, the United States must hold itself accountable to fair and just treatment for all."
And that was our episode about the Iran-India trade ties and also two Pakistani brothers finally reaching home after spending two decades at Guantanamo without charges. Take great care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
bankruptcies in Sweden increased for the seventh consecutive month in February, with retailers squeezed by declining household consumption, and the construction industry is struggling in the wake of an ongoing housing market rout. Sweden's economy is buckling under the weight of soaring consumer prices and increased borrowing costs. A recession may already be underway, as indebted households, whose mortgage rates are typically fixed for short periods, tighten purse strings, and a plunge in housing prices is rapidly reducing investments in new dwellings. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, bankruptcies in Sweden soared for the seventh consecutive month in February amid declining household consumption and growing pressure on construction companies from an ongoing housing market crunch, Bloomberg reported recently. A severe slump in Sweden's real estate sector has damaged the Nordic region's largest economy, which is struggling with surging consumer prices and growing interest rates. The country has been facing its worst housing price plunge in three decades, which has led to a reduction in investments in new dwellings. The situation has contributed to a surge in defaults in the country, according to the media outlet, citing Credit Reference Agency, UC. The number of bankruptcy filings in February jumped by 11% year-on-year. The retail and the motor vehicle trade industries were hit the hardest last month. UC economist Johanna Blum said in a statement, "The number of bankruptcies is still at a high level and has increased compared with last year," adding that there is little optimism ahead as more rate hikes are expected while inflation isn't slowing. In February, the largest Swedish company that declared bankruptcy was air carrier Air Leap, with annual sales of 278 million kronor, that is $27 million, Bloomberg said, citing Credit Safe. The Swedish government announced at the end of 2022 that the country was entering a recession that would last until 2025. The development reflects an EU-wide trend as the bloc teeters on the edge of a recession. In February, a statistics agency Eurostat reported a wave of bankruptcies among EU businesses, which surged to the highest level in the fourth quarter of 2022 since records began in 2015. Defaults jumped by 26.8% compared to the previous 3 months, Eurostat said, noting that the number of bankruptcy declarations increased during all four quarters of 2022. The accommodation and food services industries were hit the hardest in the final 3 months of 2022 compared to the same period of 2019, with a 97.7% increase in insolvencies among EU businesses. High inflation and interest rate hikes will affect many Swedish households and slow down the country's economic growth next year. A leading bank said in a report published recently, Trend report citing Xinhua, Sweden's gross domestic product GDP growth is expected to be -1.1% next year, said Mattias Persson, Swedbank's chief economist and global head of macro research, in an interview with Swedish television SVT recently. The Swedish central bank's policy rate is expected to increase from the present 1.75% to 3% by February, according to Swedbank's latest economic outlook. It expects inflation and unemployment rates to reach 7.4% and 7.6% respectively in 2023. In consequence, Swedish households are expected to spend a higher proportion of their disposable income on mortgages since 1990s, a situation which Persson said would have a wider effect on the Swedish economy. Persson told SVT the labor market still shows resilience, but the situation is expected to worsen when employment-intensive industries such as retail and construction are affected. In its latest economic forecast, the European Commission said Swedish economy would be the worst performing in the EU in 2023. Recently, Statistics Sweden published a report showing that Sweden's gross domestic product decreased by 0.9% in the fourth quarter of 2022 compared with the third quarter. Jessica Engdahl, head of section at National Accounts Department, Statistics Sweden said, GDP contracted in the fourth quarter with a broad downturn in capital formation and household consumption. Compared with the previous quarter, gross fixed capital formation in the fourth quarter decreased by 0.8%. Exports went down by 1%, imports down by 1.1%, and market production shrank by 1.3%. Though the full-year GDP of 2022 increased by 2.4% from last year, several major banks have given negative predictions of Sweden's GDP this year. Swedbank expected a decline of 1.3%, SEB expected it to shrink by 1.2%, and Nordi, more pessimistic, forecast a 2% decline. The slowdown in economic activities also take a toll on households. Household final consumption decreased by 0.2% in the fourth quarter compared with the previous quarter, with decreased expenditure on furnishings and household equipment. Food and consumption abroad mainly contributed to the downturn. Households' real disposable income decreased by 2.7% compared with the fourth quarter of 2021. Mattias Persson, chief economist at Swedbank, told Swedish television, households will have a tough time. In his view, Riksbank, Sweden's central bank, needs to act more than previously thought because a very weak krona was also to blame. The chief economist added that the Swedish households took considerably more of a beating than those in the rest of Europe and the US, due partly to the krona weakened by the inflation shock and partly to the fact that Swedes are generally more indebted and more sensitive to interest rate increases. Swedbank, forecasting housing prices to continue downward, said this in turn leads to the housing market in Sweden standing out as one of the hardest hits in the entire Western world right now. Earlier this month, the European Commission said in its winter 2023 economic forecast that Swedish economy would be the worst performing in the European Union in 2023, with an estimated decline of 0.8% this year.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
French interference in Africa had ended. These were the words of the French President Emmanuel Macron before departing for his African tour, which begged the question, didn't his African tour mean that it had not ended? Macron's destinations, Gabon, Angola, Congo, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. His goal? To restore his influence after a series of military and political setbacks. Africanization, as opposed to Francafrique, which Macron said is over. But what is Francafrique? Francafrique refers to the time after the wave of decolonization in 1960, when France propped up dictators in its former colonies in exchange for access to resources and military bases. Some of France's colonies in West Africa included Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Benin, Guinea, the Ivory Coast, and Niger. Macron and his predecessors, notably François Hollande, have said that the policy is dead, and that France had no intention of meddling in sovereign affairs. But not all Africans are buying it. Like this Congolese resident who said that France was turning its attention to Central Africa because of a breakdown in relations with former West African colonies. To say that France has a crisis or breakdown in relations on its hand is an understatement. On the one hand, Macron has repeatedly sought to shake off the label of former colonial power, motivated by commercial gain. And when it comes to France's military involvement, the security crisis in West Africa's Sahel region had fueled anti-French protests, bringing juntas to power in Burkina Faso and Mali, which did not want long-standing military ties with France. France was forced to withdraw troops from former colonies, Burkina Faso, the Central African Republic, and from Mali. This was not a matter of choice, and it is quite evident since France still desires to have some kind of military footprints in these countries.
Au fond, la logique, c'est que notre modèle ne doit plus être celui de bases militaires telles qu'elles existent aujourd'hui.
The French President Emmanuel Macron must have deemed Africa to be so important that he decided on this tour. He urged French companies to bid for contracts in Africa and to be more respectful of African nations. But the French president may have an ulterior motive behind his visit. Russia. France was forced to withdraw its forces from Mali last year after the junta opted to work with Russian forces. And to add salt to injury, the Central African Republic had also chosen to work with Russian forces. This was a big worry for France, since there was now a domino effect which excluded France, coming at a time when Western countries are trying to lobby the Global South against Russia over its special military operation in Ukraine. African countries' decision to work with Russia may be a reflection of a bigger wave of anti-Western sentiments, which is not restricted to France only. The U.S. has also fallen behind in Africa, and like France, not only blasts Russia for its presence in Africa, but has also slammed China for its investments in the continent. The former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton couldn't make it any clearer when he said predatory practices by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa and threaten nations' economic independence. It appears that African nations are no longer buying that view and have made the shift to countries that are providing them with what they want, security cooperation and trade rewards, as is the case with Russia and China, in line with the new world order that is taking shape. The Israeli regime is stepping up its violent and racist policies against Palestinians. On Thursday, a young Palestinian man succumbed to his injuries that he recently sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, also known as Ariha. 22-year-old Mahmoud Jamal Hamdan was critically wounded during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp. On Wednesday, Israeli troops stormed the Aqaba Jab refugee camp,
following a shooting attack on a highway outside of Jericho that left one Israeli soldier dead. During the raid, the regime's forces sealed off the camp and prevented ambulances and journalists from entering it. They also fatally wounded Hamdan, whom they accused of being involved in the attack. Regime atrocities come against the backdrop of increasing settler violence against Palestinians. On Sunday night, hundreds of armed Israeli settlers, flanked by soldiers, attacked Palestinian villages near the West Bank town of Huwara and set fire to homes, storefronts, and cars.
I was here yesterday when the incident occurred. I didn't know how to escape, as they closed immediately all roads and exits. So I was obliged to stay here. I locked the door, and after that, the settlers came to burn things. They set fire to all the wood I had, the car, and they burned the area.
At least one Palestinian was killed and nearly 400 were wounded in the hours-long rampage, which was denounced by Israeli rights group Peace Now and B'Tselem as a settler pogrom supported by the occupying regime. Palestinian officials have called on the U.S. Security Council to ensure protection for Palestinians who have increasingly come under deadly attacks by Israeli forces and settlers.
What we have seen here in this house is evidence of how big the crime carried out by the settlers and covered by army and protected by the army is. It is clear that this move is supported by a political decision from the Israeli cabinet. Therefore, three sides are partners in this crime. The cabinet, which takes the political decision, the army, which is protecting the settlers, and the settlers who are implementing. This is what we have seen here.
The Arab League has also said that it fully holds the far-right Israeli administration, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, responsible for the systematic crimes committed by extremist settlers. After they went on a violent rampage in the West Bank, Israeli forces have killed nearly 70 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. On Tuesday, the Israeli Knesset approved a bill authorizing the execution of Palestinian detainees, conduct anti-occupation operations. Hamas resistance movement has strongly condemned the bill, noting that the move reflects the regime's, quote, fascist tendencies. Hamas has stressed that such policies and laws will not deter the Palestinian people from continuing their legitimate resistance against the Israeli occupation. Furthermore, on Wednesday, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who is an ultra-nationalist in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist coalition, said that the Palestinian village of Huwara should be wiped out.
All over Israel, here in Tel Aviv and elsewhere, we are protesting against the horrific pogrom committed by the extremist settlers in the West Bank yesterday. They came because they have the support of the government. They have the support of high-ranking Kahanist ministers serving in the government, and they are deepening the occupation, deepening the bloodshed.
So we are here tonight to demonstrate after the settlers in Huwara attacked and burned the village and the people who live in Huwara, the Palestinian people. And we are here to demonstrate to stop the occupation.
Even the U.S. administration, which is Tel Aviv's staunch ally, has called the remarks repugnant. Attacks against Palestinians have escalated since late December 2022, when Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power as prime minister of the occupying regime's most far-right cabinet ever. Netanyahu is now under mounting pressure. Streets across the occupied territories have witnessed mass protests since Netanyahu's controversial move to reform the judiciary. Opponents argue that the legal changes threaten the independence of judges and weaken oversight of the ruling cabinet and parliament. They say the plan will undermine the rights of minorities and would open the door to more corruption. But Netanyahu, who is on trial for corruption, says the changes will boost business. There are now threats that his coalition cabinet will break up due to internal differences and mass protests.
A year has passed since the ongoing war in Ukraine broke out. Prospects for an end to the war look bleak. Instead of supporting dialogue and a peaceful resolution, the West, particularly the U.S., have fanned the flames of war by sending billions of dollars in arms to Ukraine. This trend has only further escalated the conflict. Last week, Beijing called for a comprehensive ceasefire as it released a peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. The document, which covers 12 aspects, adheres to the principle of respecting the sovereignty of both countries. It calls for resuming peace talks and promotes the post-conflict reconstruction in the long run. Beijing also demanded an end to unilateral sanctions on Russia and criticized NATO expansion, saying the US and NATO are fanning the flames and adding fuel to the fire, and they are the culprit and pusher of the crisis. China also made clear its opposition to not only the use of nuclear weapons, but the threat of deploying them, saying nuclear weapons must not be used and nuclear wars must not be fought. In addition, China also called for efforts to set up humanitarian corridors for the evacuation of civilians from conflict zones, to protect civilians and prisoners of war, and to facilitate grain exports. China has sought to position itself as a neutral party in the conflict and play the role of a mediator. Meanwhile, Russia said it has paid a lot of attention to the plan by China, but the conditions for a peaceful resolution of the conflict were not in place. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, "For now, we don't see any of the conditions that are needed to bring this whole story towards peace." Moscow had said that any settlement of the conflict needed to recognize Russia's control over four Ukrainian regions it annexed last year. It also wants Ukraine to renounce its bid to join NATO. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country needed to work with China, arguing it seems that there is a respect for Ukraine's territorial integrity and security issues in the Chinese perspective. However, Kyiv said that it will not agree to any peace without the return of all its territory. The publication of the proposal follows accusations from the West that China is considering arming Russia, a claim Beijing has dismissed as false information. Ukraine's head of military intelligence has brushed aside claims that China is considering sending arms to Russia. Kirill Budanov told US media that he saw no signs that such things are even being discussed. That's after senior US officials said that they were confident China was considering providing lethal equipment to Moscow. Earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken aired Washington's concerns about potential arms shipments in a tense meeting with his Chinese counterpart. Also, the director of the CIA, William Burns, said in an interview on Sunday that he believed Beijing was still weighing the possibility. Asked specifically about the U.S. assessment, Budanov said, "I am the head of intelligence and I rely with all due respect not on the opinions of individual people but only on facts. I do not see such facts." China says it has kept contact with all sides in the crisis, including Kyiv, and its position was clear. The core is to call for peace and promote dialogue and promote a political solution to the crisis. China has warned that the war in Ukraine is getting out of control. Beijing has urged certain countries to stop adding fuel to the fire, saying it's deeply concerned about the situation. Beijing rejected the US and NATO claims as false and said it is the US that is endlessly sending arms to Ukraine, not China. The US and NATO have been warning China against sending weapons to Russia, while they have been providing Ukraine with billions of dollars in arms and military aid since the beginning of the war a year ago.
US' desire to dominate the world by poking its nose into other countries' affairs, especially when things are not in its favor, is not hidden anymore. In the latest example, Russia has come out accusing Washington of attempting to disrupt its relations with nations on the African continent. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov said the United States and its allies are conducting an unprecedented campaign for Russia's political and economic isolation, including the disruption of the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg scheduled for July. Bogdanov said Western countries embarked on their collective campaign to isolate Russia in the international arena ever since the beginning of the special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the West, in order to achieve its anti-Russia agenda, has significantly piled up pressure on African countries through threats of imposing sanctions, termination of financial and humanitarian aid. Bogdanov's assessment came more than a month after Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited South Africa as part of his African tour. During Lavrov's visit to Pretoria, which was the second since last year, the two sides pledged to boost bilateral ties. In a joint presser, top South African diplomat Naledi Pandor even